Don Podesta and the manager editor at the Center for International Media Assistance here at the National Endowment for Democracy. SEMA is a net initiative that aims to strengthen the support, raise the visibility, and improve the effectiveness of media assistance programs worldwide. To do this, we publish research reports and host discussions, such as this one, to highlight the indispensable role of independent media in democracy, whether by holding governments accountable, fostering free and open elections, strengthening civil society, or promoting the rule of law. This afternoon's discussion will focus on the role of ombudsmen and press councils in self-regulation in international media, which is one of SEMA's most recently published reports, Sword and Shield. A major question remains as to whether these institutions, press councils, ombudsmen, are effective in raising journalistic standards, or if they too easily can become tools for governments to manipulate the news media, especially where democracies are fragile. Other questions that will be covered are, what are the differences in approach, scope, effectiveness, and independence of these institutions? What examples of successful press councils or ombudsmen internationally, and what we can learn from them? What are the major obstacles to their effectiveness? How can media development implementers in the field help news outlets overcome these obstacles? We hope the discussion will lead to a deeper understanding of both the positive and negative roles ombudsmen and press councils can play in various developing countries. Before I introduce the speakers, I'd like to mention that today's workshop agenda and the attendee list is available at the side of the room over by the door, so please take a copy if you have not already. And now, in the middle of the table below is Bill Risto, the author of the report, a journalist and international journalism trainer based in Seattle, Washington. After beginning his career as an editor with weekly newspapers in San Francisco and rural Washington State, he worked at the Seattle Times for nearly 23 years. Risto was a Knight International Journalism Fellow in Uganda for 9 months in 2007, training professional journalists at newspapers in Kampala and other towns. He returned to East Africa as a trainer and consultant in 2008 with his wife, Teresa Morrow, working with four newspapers in Uganda and Kenya, and again in 2009, teaching graduate students of journalism in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Bill will give about a 20-minute presentation in his report, and then our two responders will chime in. Our first is Alicia Shepherd, sitting to Bill's left. She joined National Public Radio in October 2007 for a two-year appointment as ombudsman. She serves as the public's representative and is responsible for bringing transparency to the journalism decision-making process at NPR. She responds to queries and comments from listeners, writes a blog, appears on NPR programs to discuss listener concerns, and provides guidance on journalism practices to NPR member stations. Before coming to NPR, Alicia spent 4 years teaching journalism and contributing to a number of newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times, Washingtonian Magazine, Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and the New York Star-Ledger, and the Washington Post. She has also written a book, Woodward and Bernstein, Life in the Shadow of Watergate, and is the co-author of Running Towards Danger, Stories Behind the Breaking News of 9/11. Alicia will discuss Bill's report from the perspective of an ombudsman and focus on some of the challenges that ombudsmen face. To Alicia's left is Mark Whitehouse, Director of Media Development Programs at the International Research and Exchange Board, better known as IREX. He has more than 15 years of experience in democratic and media development programs. As a director of IREX's Media Development Division since 2001, he has developed and overseen media projects in Africa, Asia, Europe, and Eurasia. Prior to joining IREX, Mark worked for the director of the Carter Center's Commission on Radio and Television Policy and was a development associate at USAID. He has conducted research on ethnic politics in the Russian Academy of Sciences, at the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute for Ethnography in Moscow. He currently serves on the board of directors of IREX Europe and the Broadcasting Training Center based in Bulgaria, I believe. Mark will be discussing the role of press councils and some of the challenges they face in the field. While we're on the subject of IREX, I'm just going to take a couple of minutes for putting a plug for our next event next week, Thursday the 16th, noon, in the same room for a discussion in conjunction with the release of IREX's Media Sustainability Index for Europe. The events are new to you all. Welcome to pick up an invitation, but also it's by the side of the door. One other bit of housekeeping. For those at the table, the little round RTD cast is in front of your microphones. You have all kinds of sound. At best, if you don't put your papers or things on top of that, just keep because the sound will pick up and be distracting. And if you can take a minute to silence your cell phones, that would be appreciated. So with that, over to you, Bill.
Everybody, I tell students to throw something at me if you can't hear, because that's easier than waving. So just throw something or shout out into your little, those are amazing little devices. I've never sat somewhere with wired tables. This is very fancy here. Is this taxpayer money? I'm not sure. No. Did anybody else have the same thought I did, which was, he's really going to cover all of that in 20 minutes? I had that reaction. This is a huge topic. We're going to be talking, is this going to come on? This will come on as it warms up. There will be a small PowerPoint. I will try not to be a slave to it. And there will not be any tests, but there will be some numbers involved, so be careful. This is a huge topic. The topic is broadly speaking, media self-regulation. It's about different ways that journalists themselves regulate their own work. We're trying to focus it a little bit by saying, okay, we're going to focus on the two biggest areas, which is ombudsman and press councils. Ombudsman, you might also know as public editors. There's a variety of names. Press councils are often known as news councils or media councils. We're going to try to focus it even further by saying our primary area of interest is international efforts at media self-regulation. We're going to limit ourselves to try to limit ourselves to efforts that we have reason to believe are quote independent, that is, they're not controlled by governments or corporations. Even with all of that, it's still a pretty broad topic. And in particular, because we don't want it to be just an academic conversation, I'll be talking about this a little bit, and expecting you to think about it and ask questions about it. Is media self-regulation a good investment? Is it a good investment in support of press freedom? Even with all that, 20 minutes isn't enough, all of that limiting. But that's what we're going to talk about. I'm going to look forward a lot to hearing from my two colleagues here, because they've spent a lot of time on some very interesting front lines. Particularly Alicia, I think, has seen, we'll be talking a little bit about the barriers to success of these. I say in the report that the ombudsman is pretty much as thankless a job as you can get. There's the people who do appreciate the ombudsman tend to be members of the public who will never in 100 years tell you that they appreciate it, but they do. She's been on the front lines actually doing it. Mark's been on the front lines throughout the world seeing how these operations work. So I'm looking forward to hearing from them, and then after that I'm really looking forward to hearing from all of you guys. So since we're going to talk about press freedom, let's talk quickly about the major threats. Everybody knows the threat of government interference. That's the first thing that usually comes to your mind when you say a threat to press freedom. It's repression of various kinds, putting people in prison, closing newspapers or television or radio stations down. That's super large threat. Litigation is one that you don't hear about as much, but I'm sure Mark knows of this as a huge threat. It's what this really refers to is that a lot of people in the developing world especially use defamation lawsuits as their way of dealing with problems in the media. A defamation lawsuit can be a very effective way of dealing with problems, and it gets rid of those journalists almost as well as putting them in prison, and sometimes it does put them in prison. This one is not as visible in the development world because it hasn't had a chance to get there yet, but it will. And it's, this is, to me, a lesser known area of threat to press freedom, but it's a very real one, particularly in this country. Well, is this involved when the Washington Post has its little flap that it just had? Yeah. Is that a potential threat to press freedom? Yeah, it is. Is that involved when the Los Angeles Times prints an ad on page one that kind of looks like a story? Yeah. These things are, those are real threats to press freedom. This doesn't just happen in the developing world. It happens right here at home. Is it a threat when Alicia's organization of ombudsmen is shrinking every year in its membership within the United States because when a budget gets tight, that's one of the first things to go? Am I wrong about that? I don't think so. I know in Miner's paper that was the case. So those are real threats to press freedom. And we're going to touch on those as we talk about how self-regulatory bodies can deal with those things. But there's another one that I think is a little less commonly mentioned as a threat to press freedom. It's a little counterintuitive, maybe. And that would be this. Too often, and with far greater consequence than you realize, journalists fail at a critically important task. Anybody, I don't want to make this totally interactive, but does anybody think of what I mean by a critically important task that journalists fail at?
There's so many.
Speak into your microphone. Listen. Here's a hint. Who do they fail to listen to? Yeah, and there they are. I call them the readers because I've got this horrible print bias from many, many years of doing it, but they're not just the readers, they're really the public. I've used this slide these are all Ugandan, so that's when it started, but I've used it in Kenya, I've used it in Ethiopia, and the point of this slide for journalists is, ultimately, it comes down to one big important thing. Who do we really work for? That's critical for them when they're writing stories. It's critical for them when they're deciding whether to take the brown envelope. Everybody who doesn't know what a brown envelope is in the context of journalism. A brown envelope is, thanks a lot for doing that story for us. And then you get another good one afterwards. Brown envelopes are very common in the part of the world I've worked in, and they don't just come from the corporations, they come from NGOs. NGOs are huge givers of brown envelopes because they need good stories in the newspaper, and they know that reporters don't get paid much in the developing world. So we talked to journalists about who you really work for. This one looks different because she's my wife. Well, she is. You know, when I'm a journalist, that's who asks, she says, why have you not fixed this newspaper yet? I'm trying. It takes a little while. But we need to remember the readers when we're thinking about who we work for. We need to remember that we write stories. So I use this as a journalism training tool, but this is a critically important issue for self-regulatory bodies as well. This is a quote from a journalist, from an editor. And the important part of his quote is this. It's very easy for us when we're talking about journalism in the developing world to just talk about the highfalutin notions of press freedom and freedom from the government and all the rest, and have our press councils concentrate, and then neglect the other responsibility of the council, which is to defend the public interests against abuses by the press. The press is not perfect. Surprise. It's not perfect in this country, and internet certainly is not perfect in the countries we're talking about, which are countries where the institutions of journalism are still emerging. Often they're 10, at most 20 years old. And if the self-regulatory body only focuses on repression from the government, only focuses on being defensive about the press, and doesn't look at the issues of lapses by the press, it will fail. Another person who put this very well was David Dadge. Some of you may know, he's head of the International Press Institute based in Vienna, Austria. Said to me, and they're the ones who, one of the groups that monitors how many journalists are in prison because of repression. He said to me, too many journalists in Africa are in prison simply because they got the story wrong. They made mistakes. Their standards weren't high. He thinks that the strongest thing we could do, one of the strongest things we could do in defense of press freedom is raising the standards of journalists, and that's what this is about. So raising the standards of journalists, making their stories more accurate, giving them higher credibility has a strong, strong business argument, and it's also probably the strongest way to defend against a repressive government, or a government that wants to control you or censor you. Okay. Quick overview. So there's two types of self-regulatory bodies. Ombudsman and press councils. We're going to talk a little bit more at ombudsman. There's many, many different models. Some of them are actually work on the staff of the news organization that they are covering. Alicia, how are you? You have a 2-year contract, you said.
Right. So I am paid by National Public Radio.
Right.
I have staff privileges and staff benefits.
Okay, and you work in their office?
Yes.
Some work in the office, some work out of the office. There's something called ONO, the Organization of News Ombudsmen. Really, their only rule is that this has to be, A, it has to be independent in some way, it has to have some way that shows that you're not controlled by the news organization. And the other is that what you do has to be visible to the public. You can't just be doing an in-house critique for the news organization. You have to be telling the public, responding to the public. Press councils, news councils are a different breed. They usually are working in a much larger geographical territory, often the whole country. They can be more problematic in terms of being independent. You have to watch them carefully. We'll talk about this in a minute. I told you there's a few numbers. Any guesses? No guesses. 1809 was when the concept of, this is sort of esoteric history for you, but I know that you're interested in that. 1809 is when the concept of ombudsmanship was invented. It had nothing to do with journalism at that time. It had to do with simply somebody to oversee problems with government in Sweden, I think it was.
Yeah.
Interestingly, 1916, also in Sweden, they have a lot of time on their hands, it's cold in the winter, they have nothing to do. In 1916, they invented the first press council in Sweden. In the 1920s, the first journalism ombudsman was invented, and I think that was in Japan. I'm not sure, it says so in the report somewhere. 40 is the approximate number of which is 40. 40 is the approximate number of press councils that are considered independent. They're members of one of two international organizations of press councils. So there's approximately 40 of these around the world. 48 is the number of actual professional members of the Organization of News Ombudsmen. There's more press councils than 40, there's more ombudsmen than 48, but these are all ones that have been vetted in some fashion. So roughly speaking, those are the numbers. I think this number is growing outside of America. It's shrinking in America. This number goes up and down, and I think this, the press council one is a really difficult one to track, because, and we'll talk about this when we talk about barriers, because it's hard to tell which ones are independent and they change. So, different cultural contexts. In developed countries, the primary role of these outfits, whether it's ombudsmen or press councils, is to accept complaints from the public about the performance of the media. Often, these organizations attract suspicion from the media, from within the media. Anybody who has been around journalism for a really long time remembers that in, I don't know, the early 1980s, I think, or late 70s, there was a National News Council was formed in the United States, and it was an attempt to actually have a news council that would accept complaints from all around the country about issues that were going on in the media. Major news organizations, particularly including the New York Times and I think CBS, objected to this. Didn't like it, thought this was intrusion. Nobody can ask us questions. Haven't you guys all seen Watergate, Woodward and Bernstein, the film? Don't question what we do. I note in the report that in, 1995, when Mike Wallace was accepting an award, he said, we were wrong when we opposed this. There's good reason to ask questions about the media. But in the West, there's often suspicion from the media about these councils. In countries where institutions are developing, you actually have the ombudsman and the press councils will get complaints from journalists about the government, as well as from just private parties who do still object. But these two things are big differences in the developing world. News councils, and to some extent ombudsmen, play a role that universities, professional organizations, other organizations like that play in the West. They provide education and training for journalists. They provide institutional advocacy for the media. So you'll see the press council of Tanzania, on the one hand, criticizing newspapers for running a photograph that was misidentified, and on the other hand, taking on the government for closing down a weekly newspaper. So they'll do this kind of institutional advocacy. They will hold seminars for journalists. They'll create codes of conduct. They'll do all sorts of things that are handled over here by different sorts of institutions. So they have a much, much bigger role and an important role for that reason. By the way, ask questions if they come to mind. Throw something again. Very quickly, I wanted to talk about a couple of case studies that I thought were especially interesting. Bosnia. I mean, I can hardly imagine being a journalist in Bosnia, much less being a person who's trying to bat what is going on with journalism. And it's a country where for half a century, propaganda is what was journalism. It's a country where journalists hate each other, are prepared to kill each other, have fought each other for many, many years. And it's a country where, well, two different people, separate people who I talked to when I asked them what were the challenges for being a journalist or a news council in Bosnia, they use the exact same word, bully. Bully. Like, in other words, The best way to make sure a newspaper or a TV station does what you want it to do in Bosnia is to get somebody from organized crime to bully them. You just tell them, as threats. It's a very old-fashioned technique.
Is that right now?
Right now. Right now, today. In fact, it's getting worse. As one of the quotes in the report says, we get threats from the government and from organized crime, but it's really hard to tell them apart. It's a brutal situation. They do have a press council, and the press council is doing things like drawing university students from the different ethnic areas together to talk about journalism. They worked on developing a code of standards. They're bringing newspaper publishers together to talk about joint advertising packages. You know, that's something that a news council in the West would never do, but they have to do, they're doing this to try to financially help their organizations. At the same time, they're trying to deal with corporations and government and organized crime that threaten you if you write articles. And at the same time, they're trying to deal with a pervasive element in Bosnia, which is that the publishers will attack each other on the front page of their own newspaper. So there's these little warfares within the press. So my hat is off to them. Good for them. It's hard work. And we shall see. The book is in no way closed on whether they will have an impact, but they have had an impact in just the simple things they've accomplished by getting people together to talk about common issues. The other one, just because I wanted to mention, what an ombudsman can do in Brazil. The ombudsman for the newspaper Folha de São Paulo. Here's a quote from a column that he wrote for them early in 2009. Folha's work was lazy as ever. It does not need to be that way. A minimum of editorial effort could make coverage of the world of Brasilia much more relevant for the country. He writes a weekly report for the journalists within the newspaper. He also writes a regular report for the readers. He works out of his home, but he comes to the office about once a week to talk with people there. He's great because at the end of his column each week he recommends journalism books and movies that you might want to watch. And so that's good. It's kind of fun. He has an entertainment aspect, but he's extremely sharp-tongued. He pointed out that their letters to the editor column were simply full of people arguing one or people with interests in the stories, not from ordinary readers. They didn't publish letters that came from ordinary readers. So he pointed that out, and pretty soon they adopted a new policy. He pointed out that they, and then just on mundane issues, he pointed out that they were writing about billions and trillions and all sorts of large numbers that were impossible to understand and weren't doing anything to make them clear. They started publishing graphics, et cetera. I admire what he does too. And he, I think, he has like a 2-year contract that is just about over, but, and we will hear stories from front line about what you have had to do, which I know is similar. But he approached it clearly from the point of view of that slide. He knows who he works for. He works for the readers, he works for the public. He reads the paper and he elevates their standards as a result of that. That will serve the cause of press freedom by strengthening the public's commitment to the newspaper. Quick look. These are specific barriers to the success of self-regulatory efforts. You'll see that in some ways they're similar to the challenges to press freedom, but they have some specific applications. Governments, the biggest barrier as far as governments goes is to press councils, not to ombudsmen. And the barrier is that some governments have figured out, hey, this is a cool idea. we can set up a media council. It will sound like it's independent, and we can make pronouncements through it, and the public will think it's independent. There's a lot of these around the world. There's really a lot of them in Africa. There was one in Egypt that was kicked out of one of the international associations of news councils because it was too much an arm of the government. And it can be very hard to know whether they're government controlled unless you look very carefully not even just where their funding comes from. You have to look at how they operate, what their contract is, what their terms of freedom of what they can say is. So governments are a threat in that way. They're a barrier to effective self-regulatory bodies. Funding issues is big for ombudsmen. I mean, the example in the United States where we're losing ombudsmen every year. I don't remember how many we lost in the last year. I think it's
11.
Yeah, just in 1 year. And that's not a very large number, so the percentage is very high. That's bad. For news councils, you know, you think of an example like the Bosnian one, which is not uncommon really. Those are not, they're not hugely expensive, but they're not cheap to operate. They very commonly will start off with funding from an international funding group. And then the woman in charge of the media council in Peru told me, the trouble is, everybody has moved on to other topics now. Peru is no longer sexy. They're going to work in other parts of the world. We're afraid of losing our funding from the various funding groups. They badly need it. They need to get funding from their own organizations. Bosnia is working on this right now, working on getting the newspaper publishers to support them, which will be a major step if they can accomplish it. The funding will, in fact, end up killing off news councils around the world. A barrier to excessive self-regulation is the aggressive public. I'm going to let Alicia have fun with that one. The public does not bother press councils as much, maybe as it does ombudsman. I think every ombudsman has to learn and will learn very quickly that when you publish your email address and phone number somewhere on your website, you are opening yourself up to orchestrated campaigns from the public. You come into your job, I think, thinking, oh good, my job is just to represent the public and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to represent the public. And then you find out that the public is kind of messy too. And especially the days when you can generate mass mailings of email like that. And so there will be orchestrated campaigns. This doesn't just happen in America. It happens all around the world. And so the press, the ombudsman have to worry about that, have to be able to sort out the different charges and counter charges from the aggressive public. There are certainly the threat countries that have the loud defamation lawsuits, that's a threat to the work of a news council because people are less likely to bring their complaints to the news council. Lack of media cooperation is a big one. One of the people in Kenya told me, you know, in Africa, we just don't have much of a tradition of peer cooperation. You don't see groups of publishers willing to work together to support a common cause. So that can be a barrier and prevent them from doing the kind of work that they should be doing. So there are internal issues that affect the success of self-regulatory bodies. Quickly then, this is based on things that are written other places, especially from some funding agencies, including UNESCO, but also that were mentioned by people I talked to around the world. The types of self-regulatory bodies that are most successful are likely to have these attributes. They're created by journalists, not created by the government or even by university. Created by journalists, you have to have that buy-in. They're supported by the industry in some fashion. Ombudsmen are clearly supported by the industry because in some way the organization or a parent organization is paying the salary. News councils that are not supported in any way by the industry are ultimately going to founder. This is any form of effective media self-regulation is going to need to be sure that if there is not already a code of standards, that one is written, distributed to journalists, either within the organization or around the country, and then followed. One of the most striking things about working in these countries is how fresh this institution is. It's not surprising that an institution that's only 10 or 20 years old does not have clear standards, does not have strong traditions of education building up to it. Writing down those standards and then calling people to task for it is one of the most important things you can do. David Gadstock, you know, his approach would be start with an ombudsman in every news organization. If that ombudsman, because that's an internal person, that's a person that the organization is committed to and can call them to task publicly. If that doesn't resolve things, then move upward to a news council. But starting from the top down may be less likely to be the most effective. Focus on your standards, focus on the quality of what you're doing. That will provide you your best defense against a government that might want to shut you down. Adequate funding with no strings attached. The press council in India, which is incredibly active and seems to be effective, is funded in large part, I'm not sure percentage, by the government. But the statutory rules for that, which are published on the government's own website, give that council full independence. And actually, probably 1/4 of all the complaints that the press council in India handles are about the government. And
what percent?
Pardon me?
What percent are handled
by? I think about 1/4 are complaints that come from journalists about things that local governments have done or the national government. And the press council seems to do a very honest and effective job of addressing those and talking about them. So it's not impossible to have government funding. It's just critical that it be in statute protect the independence of the council. And some councils have provisions. Now this probably does have to come from statute in some way that say before you can file they have to have some protection against defamation lawsuits. South Africa, the News Council has a provision that you can bring your complaint to us. This is a good place to bring your complaint because it will be cheap for you. We will resolve it quickly. We're independent and fair, and we will publicize the results. But if you want us to handle your complaint, you have to sign something that says you will not take it to litigation. You will not go for a defamation lawsuit if you're not happy with our result. That's one way to deal with it, and people do that because there is a major advantage to going to a news council. So people will do, that's one form of protection. You can also have statutory protection against lawsuits. Again, if the press council is set up to be purely independent and you also say that people have to go to them first.
It might help if you explain a defamation lawsuit, exactly what you mean.
A defamation lawsuit can it's basically someone saying, I didn't like what you said about me or my company in your publication or your broadcast, and I'm gonna sue you over.
That's simple, it's not like what's, the standard isn't as high as the United States to file libels.
No, not at all. And in some countries, the burden of proof is on the, very much on the media outlet. So, and you can end, and they can be criminal cases. So you can end up in prison over it, not simply paying a fine. So they're extremely serious as an issue for journalists and for journalism standards in other countries.
Can I ask you one other question about codes of standards? Some news organizations have standards editors. These are editors who strictly enforce the code within the paper before something is published or before something goes on the air. Where does that fit in for you? Wouldn't that be a key to success?
Do you know of any of those in the developing world, Mark? Standards editors within a news organization? I never came across one. I have a more limited universe, but not a totally limited universe. Some things that are protections in the United States are not protections. When I was in Uganda, I encouraged, and ultimately successfully encouraged, the newspaper I was working with, which was government-owned, I encouraged them to start running a corrections column. First time in Uganda that anybody had run a corrections column. Besides the normal journalistic objections to corrections columns, which is, we have thin skins and we don't want to admit that we made mistakes, that's the normal. The biggest objection there was, if you admit to making an error, that's going to make you more legally liable in court. In America, it's a protection. And we had to go through some pretty good hoops with the corporate counsel at the newspaper to receive assurances that in fact that would not put them at greater risk. But the standards of culpability are much different, and that's why the defamation is such a big deal. Okay. So are they a good investment? Now I'll hand this over to my colleagues. This is a tough question. And I don't like to answer the tough questions, but just as my parting thought, I'd say, if I think about the question about whether independent bodies of self-regulation, media self-regulation, are they a good investment? This is my answer, really. That's not necessarily an answer that would satisfy all of Patrick's and Mark's M&E people, monitoring evaluation people. It's so clear if you work in one of these countries, what role in a country where every institution is still developing, and where change happens like that, it's so clear the influence that a really credible and free press has on the government, on the society, on people's ability to navigate a complicated world. And yes, I could find some ways that would satisfy the M&E people to prove this or to demonstrate its likelihood. But it's critical as societies develop, if you care about them developing in the direction of democracy or some other relatively free form of governing, to be sure that the people know what's going on. Journalism is the only thing left, I think, that is remaining standing that can do that. But to do good, effective journalism, it needs to be journalism with standards. You cannot have journalists going to jail because they made mistakes. If they go to jail because the government put them in jail, okay, we can deal with that. There's mechanisms for dealing with that. But if they go to jail because they made mistakes, that's terrible. If they take brown envelopes, and then everybody knows that they're taking brown envelopes, you're never going to get there. you're never going to get to the free and open society. So having some form in which the media polices itself, does it in an independent way, does it in a way that is transparent as much as these societies allow, remembers who we work for, yeah, I'd say it's a good investment. So that's my sermon, small sermon. I'll turn it over to my colleagues and I'll listen with interest, and I'll be very glad to, you know, be interested in our conversation about this after we're all done.
From Alicia.
Hi. I think you could probably ask that same question as to American media institutions. Is it a good investment to have an ombudsman? And you know, there is only one electronic, as in TV or outlet in Warwick, Rhode Island, that actually has an ombudsman. But television does not seem to think that it's a good investment, and they rely a lot on these so-called standards editors that make sure that the product is perfect before, or to the best it can be, before it goes out. NPR was the first electronic outlet to have an ombudsman, and that's only since 2000. They consider that it's a good investment because it really is a sign of a confident news organization to have someone that you are paying who works in within and roams the halls of your organization and yet publicly criticizes and takes them to task. So if you think about the most valuable asset any news organization has, it's credibility. And so an ombudsman is a way of enhancing the credibility, because a good ethics code, you know, will seek truth and report it, will work to minimize harm, will act independently, but the other one is to be accountable. And so an ombudsman is a way of being accountable to the public and to, I see my job as explaining NPR to the listeners and the listeners to NPR, but also advancing transparency within the news media. I feel I've been writing about the news media for over, you know, almost 15 years now. And what I see is one of the biggest problems is that the news media has, especially pre-internet, this idea of, you know, we're the gatekeepers, we know what you should and shouldn't know, we'll tell you what's valuable, what's not. And the reality is that people don't understand how, most people do not understand how journalists work. In fact, I had this delicious job at the museum in 2001 where I was going to write a book about how the public gets their idea of what journalists do by watching movies. And you know, since 1930s there have been almost 1,000 movies where journalists are protagonists. So what I'm trying to make clear is that when you have an ombudsman, you have a way of explaining how the news operation works in a very public way, of discussing the decision making. You know, I often say that if the public, and I know Don would know this, it would sit inside a budget meeting where the news staff is determining what's going to go on the front page, whether the, you know, should we run this photo? How big should we run it? Should we use that kid? Should we put his name in? Should we quote this person? I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing that goes on, and that is not the impression that the public has. The impression is just what they see in the final product, and so I feel like that is why it can be valuable, at least in the United States, which is more sophisticated in terms of the development of its media. I wanted to bring up one thing, you know, that Bill touched on, is that, yes, my job is to be the public representative. I mean, that is the definition of the ombudsman. But what happens, I mean, who is the public? NPR has, you know, depending on how you want to judge these numbers, between 20 and 27 million listeners. So who's the public? Who do I represent? What I have to bring my own journalistic experience to determine what issues are worth raising. I didn't know whether Don, where he was going, or Bill, one of you were pointing out about how, what a thankless job it is. But, you know, right now I am experiencing, really I feel like the baptism of what it means to be an ombudsman, because the issue has been raised about the word torture and whether or not the news media should use the word torture to speak about what happened to the detainees during the Bush administration. And there, you know, I mean, if you were to see the last two columns I wrote, there are over 500 negative, you know, I'm Eichmann, I'm, you know, I'm morally bankrupt, it's just, and I say, look, I'm just being a shill for good journalism. I'm saying this is, as to the word torture, this is a political debate. There are people in the Bush administration who say what was done to the detainees was done because it was necessary to preserve American safety. The Obama administration has said, yes, we think that waterboarding is torture, but we're not going to really do anything about it. And just recently, the newly confirmed CIA general counsel of the Obama administration has said, I'm not sure waterboarding is torture. So this is a political debate. I would advocate that the news media describe these techniques and not, you know, use enhanced interrogation techniques or torture. I think enhanced interrogation techniques are just as much of a euphemism. So we don't really need to go in, but this is a very sticky, uncomfortable, difficult situation. And so obviously the public that thinks that NPR should be using the word torture says that I am not representing them because I'm standing up for what I think is good journalism. So who is the public? And that gives you an idea of what you deal with as an ombudsman. So I am often accused of being a shill. I'm trying to explain news organizations. The fact that I work and have worked in many news organizations, understand how it works, I try to explain that. But what I have found and what is fascinating is just who the NPR audience is in terms of how passionate listeners are. And I think it has to do with two things. One, they pay out of their own pocket. They decide, I'm going to give you $100. There's nothing that they have to sign up for. So they have this tremendous sense of ownership. And then there's also the experience, the intimacy and authenticity of radio and hearing people's voices. And so there's this passion in the public radio audience, which is great. I'm not loving it right now. and it's just frustrating me because I really, am experiencing the internet in all its robustness in terms of being misquoted and mischaracterized, and there's no way to really fight back. And I think the sad thing is that, NPR just started a social community last September, so it's not even a year old. This is where you have to sign up, and if you want to participate, you must sign up, and then you can comment. And you'd like to, I think we're at a point of dialogue versus diatribe, and diatribe is clearly winning. The other thing I was just going to talk quickly about is that I am a member of the Organization of News Ombudsman, which I like to say is, oh no. You didn't really get the oh no. And it is, tomorrow actually, one thing I put together is an ombuddy luncheon group. And my son said to me after my first day, so, Mom, did you make any ombuddies? So you do need ombuddies because it is a thankless, lonely job. I mean, I got one phone call. that I keep listening to where this woman's saying, I really appreciate what you do. It's sort of pathetic. And the other thing is, I was on Talk of the Nation discussing the use of the word torture. And, you know, people were sending in email questions, and there was quite a bit of support. I mean, I responded to some of these emails and said, why don't you, you know, put this online? And they're like, no, I'm not going to get, because they get beat up. You know, I mean, there's definitely a community out there that they feel strongly about something, they attack. And it's the reality of the job. The good news, though, is that in emerging democracies, the concept of an ombudsman, which I know more about than press consuls, is definitely growing. I think the most unusual is in Estonia. Public television has an ombudsman. And then I know recently that one of the newspaper groups in Kenya has been working with the Organization of News Ombudsmen. I think in Palau, they would like to start this. So there's a recognition that if you want to have a free and vibrant press, you need some kind of protection.
And by the way, in Kenya, one reason they're doing that is that the government has created its own press council. So what was a fairly good independent press council is now problematic at best and maybe out of existence. So creating an in-house ombudsman would be a great advance for them.
Thank you, Lisa. Take it away, Mark.
Okay, thank you. And actually, I'd much prefer to talk about the use of torture, but, you know, the word torture, but I'll avoid that.
You have some thoughts about that.
No diatribes, no. But I first want to thank both Bill and Seema for supporting Bill and writing this report, because I've never seen things pulled together, discussing press councils and giving examples all in one place, and as well as the role of ombudsman. And so I found it very valuable and will undoubtedly keep using the report in the future. And I think as Bill closed with, talking about is it a good investment, is some form of transparent self-policing by the media a good investment? I think we all would agree with that. The question to my mind is, are press councils and ombudsmen specifically as a form of self-policing a good investment? And on that case, I'll speak as a media development practitioner, and acknowledging up front that I came into this before I read the report as a very big skeptic in general of press councils. And say that I also left the report still a skeptic. But and I'll go into some of the reasons why I thought that was the case. In talking about press councils, my skepticism and inherent suspicion of press councils really comes from the fact that three things. One is where have they been successful and proven successful? Where has the impetus for establishing press councils come from, looking globally? And third, what do press councils really do in actuality versus the principle of press councils and self-regulation? So starting with where the examples of successful press councils are, I think you mentioned that there were 40 members of the organization of press councils, and you also mentioned that they had been working to try and see which members were truly independent, and they had kicked out some. You cited Egypt as a notable example. Looking at some of the other countries on the list, not being an expert in all those countries by any means, I would question whether some of those also belong in there as being independent and successful. In terms of that press council organization saying they are independent. I think if you look at the idea of where really successful press councils are,
I wonder, and I think it's worthy of further research, are those successful examples coming from countries either where government and society has some sort of agreement that a free press is a good idea, or countries where at least they're fairly far along that path and large elements of society believe it's a good idea, or where, you know, vibrant press, if only a vibrant print sector in many of these cases, is already developed, which raises a question, is a press council in that case actually a result of that development, or did it contribute to that development? And that's the thing I think needs further research. I'm not fully convinced in many of the cases that it was a press council that helped to develop professionalism and helped to stave off government regulation of the sector.
It could be both, actually.
Yeah, it could be, and I think it is worthy of further research, and I'm not saying that would have been a book if you had been assigned that task to go into all of those countries. You know, in looking at some of the examples, India, you cite as one of those. I think India is a, you know, has had a very vibrant print sector, at least, and has the press council helped improve that or not? I don't know for sure, and I wonder about that, if that is the case. You also then cite Bosnia as an example, and I think in the actual report more as a question, where is this going? It's a press council that was established many years before it was sort of revitalized, I think in 2005,
yeah.
Indicated, and had been kind of dormant. But Bosnia is a case that I don't think we can draw any conclusions on that. Has it helped improve professionalism or not? I think people who do talk about the case of Bosnia sort of raise questions about that. I think in the past in IRIC's Media Sustainability Index, people have raised questions about the viability of the press council and whether it is actually contributing to improving standards. Other developing countries cited, you know, Montenegro wasn't a case study, but there's a mention there of that. I think by and large, a lot of people think that that has not succeeded. It's still going, but it hasn't been successful to date. The second point I want to make is what is oftentimes the impetus behind the formation of press councils, and this gets to couple of points that Bill made about what are the major threats to press freedom. And government interference led the list there. And what are the barriers to self-regulation? And of course, leading the list there was government again. I think a lot of, in my experience, a lot of press councils have arisen, which isn't in itself necessarily a bad thing, but have arisen in response to government threats. And oftentimes have arisen, as you point out, through government legislation, which is not necessarily therefore an independent press council. But I think we all see that governments use the reality, but also the excuse of lack of professionalism in the media to say that this is a reason why they can't provide more press freedom. You know, you see it whether it's what's going on in Rwanda now with media law, or case in Yemen where government and government representatives are saying, publicly saying things such as, we would love to, you know, give you more freedom. You know, we really are committed to press freedom, but you are not professional yet. And so therefore then the next step is, well, let's set up some sort of self-regulatory body. We may legislate it, but let's set that up. And after that works, then we'll revisit the issue of press freedom. So it's sort of like it's a case of saying, trust us. You know, we'll get back to your issue of press freedom. And it's concerning to me as a development person that we not fall into that trap, that these things have to be pushed simultaneously, and that support for truly independent self-regulatory bodies not allow the government the excuse to come in and say, well, we're going to wait in terms of increasing press freedom, in terms of modifying our legislation. And we see that's the case, that this is a major excuse that they use. A couple of other cases where press councils, like what is the impetus behind press councils? It's not always the government of the country. Very often it's the international community. I think Bosnia's press council in its initial formation was started at the impetus of the international community. Montenegro's was started at the impetus of the international community. So that, I only throw that out there as a cautionary note, because you, as you indicated, both in the report and here, that really it's going to be successful only if it's driven from below by the journalists themselves. And I think those of us who have worked in development all see that when someone from the donor community or the implementer community comes with some form of money, suddenly everyone loves a press council. So it's hard to navigate, is this truly driven by below, or is it driven by the fact that you can get a $50,000 grant if you do this? That's simply a cautionary note, I would say. And I think that was one of the failures of Bosnia before they sort of tried to revitalize it, was that there was never buy-in at the initial stages. It was the international community pushed it, I believe, and therefore people sort of went along with it. But, you know, when as you say, the donor interest sort of fades, the woman from Peru indicated, in Bosnia, I think when that interest faded, any activity of the press council also faded there. And only recently sort of revitalized it. The third area, I just, as another cautionary note, is I think the notion of mission creep. Wasn't phrased that way, that was my phrasing. You indicated, for instance, in Bosnia, they're talking about joint advertising packages, things like that. You cited several that do various types of training for judges, training for students. And much of this, I think, as you pointed out, is driven by the need to find independent sources of financing. But to me, it's a concern that there are existing organizations that do journalism training. There are existing organizations that help develop advertising networks. And do we risk press councils sort of chasing the money and getting distracted from their key role if we sort of encourage that? And therefore, I'd say it would be much better if press councils sort of entered into cooperative agreements with these other local organizations that do this already. And so in that sense, as I said, I came out as far as press councils, still a skeptic. And thinking that the next step, we should push Dina, is to do some in-depth research, sort of over how they work over time. Because I'd be leery of saying we should go forward and invest too much into press councils as a matter of policy. I'm not sure the evidence is entirely there to support that. On the other hand, ombudsman, far less threatening to me. and I think that it's a very good idea, and as I think the phrasing that Bill used was, talking about the head of IPI had said, this is working from the bottom up, and maybe we should start with media outlets themselves, learning to police themselves as individual outlets and be transparent with the public. The issue I would just one concern I want to throw out here is cost. In the countries we work in, a lot of these outlets don't even pay their journalists regularly or other staff regularly. So it kind of makes it a difficult thing to push the concept of ombudsman on them and say, and one, would that generate resentment within the newsroom, or are you just going to have another member on a two-year, another staff member on a two-year contract who you also don't pay? Maybe that'd work fine in that case. I'm not sure about that. But I would say, just to sort of summarize this and then pass it off, is so as media development professionals, really what does this really mean? And I'd come back to actually the words that that you closed with in saying, again, some form of transparent self-policing of the industry is very important. And I'd say maybe we should consider other methods as well and broaden the discussion to say it's not necessarily the formal post of ombudsman or the formal structure of a press council. Maybe it's as donors or implementers helping media to engage with their public more. We've done things, and I know SCHA has done things, for instance, such as helping media outlets get out and actually meet the public, engage with the public, not just go to press conferences or receive press releases. We've done things, for instance, in Moldova, what we call the roadshow, where a newspaper, we help them go around the country and have meetings in the communities to hear what they thought about the newspaper and what the issues they wanted covered were. And it was actually quite shocking to the journalists to hear this. You know, they sort of lived in a bit of a bubble and thought that everything was fine. And they got out and found that that's not the case, that they weren't necessarily credible or trusted, and the newspaper was not covering the issues that the public thought should be covered. Another perhaps approach to take to add to both press councils and ombudsman is what happens here is in the US is the whole concept of media critics. Journalists may not love them, but there is a whole industry, a cottage industry or a real industry of media criticism going on. And it doesn't exist in most of the countries we work in, that concept where there are people who, whether it's through blogs or writing in media outlets, talk about the news media, the news industry as a whole. There's very little coverage of the news industry in a lot of countries we work in. And so I think that's something to consider as a form of bringing transparency and sunlight to bear on the industry. It's maybe encouraging also this more informal process. And I think with the growth of new media, the decline of print media, which I believe will accelerate in many of the countries we do work in, that looking to this form is a good option to try. So in closing, I do think that one shouldn't rule out press councils, but my own personal view is go into that with a great deal of skepticism and a tremendous amount of caution about can they be successful in developing the profession and helping to fight off government interference. Can they be sustainable, a major point? And if they can't be sustainable, that makes them susceptible to financial interference. You mentioned corporations as another form of a threat to the press. I think that could also be the case with press councils. And finally, what sort of message would you be sending to a government? It has to be very carefully crafted as far as support for press councils. If it's poorly done, it can reinforce a government's perception that we do need a hand of regulation, self or not. So I'd close there and and say that I really thought this was a great report and raised a lot of issues I've never had to grapple with sort of on that scale before.
Thank you, Mark. Bill, would you like to respond to either or both of the responders before we have some
questions?
I
want to be sure of something, and I often find myself in this position because I get passionate about things. I wanted to be clear that this was not an advocacy report, I don't believe it was from SEMA's point of view. It wasn't from mine. And Mark's points are great, and I will one-up him. I'm skeptical about all these efforts. I'm skeptical about what ICFJ does, which I have great respect for. I was part of it and hope to continue to be a part of it. I'm skeptical about what IREX does. I know how hard it is on the ground in these countries to basically blow on these embers that are barely gray, much less glowing, and try to bring them alive. I'm skeptical about whether a roadshow around Moldova will be repeated 3 years from now without some sort of strong institutional backing and will be remembered 5 years from now. And the quote that I didn't say that I should have said, which was given to me by the head of the press council, one of the press council associations, is press councils are simply one arrow in the quiver of people who care about free press and free societies. Ombudsmen are one arrow. Media development efforts are one arrow. You're going to shoot that arrow, and you're not sure where it's going to land every time. You're not going to know. And sometimes it's going to be friendly fire and hit somebody that you didn't mean to hit. And sometimes it's going to land in the water and be gone. Many times that's going to happen. I'm an advocate of taking the basic principle that I put up at the very end, which is that we care about developing free societies, and we believe in a strong media as a way of developing those societies, and then brainstorming together and supporting any institution that we think will blow on those embers, studying how well it did and supporting it more if the embers start to come alive. Bosnia is a huge question mark, but I'll tell you what, I'll draw a line. It's undeniable to me that the things the Bosnia News Council has done, which is to bring journalism students from warring parts of the country together to talk about journalism standards, which is to talk to judges about journalism issues and defamation, educate them, to talk to publishers and get them to talk face-to-face about not writing editorials about each other on the front page. Those things, to me, are undeniably useful in the cause of press freedom. I don't maintain that this will solve it. And I'm not going to bet my paycheck that the Bosnia Press Council will be around 2 years from now. We have to look for a multitude of things like this. And some of them will work and some of them won't, but we cannot let our appropriate skepticism keep us from looking for the right efforts and supporting them when we think we have found them.
Could I just add that I teach media ethics at Georgetown, and what I really think I do is just teach people to think about these issues and to sort of slow down. And so as I was listening to Mark, I think just having people talk about these issues or, you know, think that they're important enough seems to me a very important first step. And as far as just throwing in what I know about press councils in the United States, there's one in Washington and there's one in Minnesota. They're effective in terms of sort of feel good, but they don't have teeth. And so they will look at issues, but they I don't think are that effective. I think that an ombudsman can work within a particular news organization, and I know that sometimes just the mere fact that I am there, I like to think that I sometimes joke that I'm like the cop at the private party. The very fact that I'm there, you're not going to take the silver. But what I do is I just ask a lot of questions, and there's so much that happens in a newsroom that is rote, automatic, we know how to do this. And so just by asking questions and forcing people to stop and think about what they do and how they do it and is there a better way to do it, I feel, raises the level of journalism.
Thank you. We still have some time for questions. We have a couple of roaming microphones, so please, or if you're talking at the table microphone, either way, please identify yourself by name and by your affiliation. I want to just ask one question and then let you all jump in. When I've spoken to groups of journalists and government officials interested in media, in Latin America in particular, I often get the question, well, who's responsible for obligating the media to behave responsibly? Who forces enforcement of standards? After reading your report, I would have been inclined to answer maybe some thought to creating some sort of a press council with media participation. After listening to Mark, now I'm not so sure. To either of you or to Alicia, what would you answer when that question is put to you in some developing country like Ecuador or Venezuela?
Well, Mark, you brought that up. Whether or not you have licensing regulations, like an AMA.
My answer has been let the marketplace decide, but that doesn't always work in a lot of countries.
No, but I think it's what Bill, in a sense, what Bill was just saying as far as developing. There's a whole variety of things going on. It's more of a system. There's not one thing. It's not a press council. It's not purely legislation. It's a whole system that is self-policing, raises professionalism, it's education, it's if there are press councils, it's press councils, if there are ombudsmen, it's all together, and which is why it opens it up to governments to say, well, I can't point to one of those, so I need one thing.
The number one thing I think that most people said to me was, and I wouldn't mention it unless I agree with it, of course, is codes of ethics. Codes of ethics created by the professionals are so important, because then that opens the door to many, many other different forms of press criticism or press regulation. But if you've got a strong code of standards and of ethics that are created by the journalists, that gives you the foundation that then makes it more likely that whatever comes next will be the thing that you want to see happen. It's a guard against the government.
Thank you. Questions from the floor? Patrick?
I want to touch on something that Mark brought up right at the end, which is, both of these things really were created in times of traditional media. Traditional media may be dying, or at least media is changing in so many ways. Pardon?
Transforming.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. And I'm wondering, in terms of press councils or media councils, can they be relevant in a time when media are proliferating and such that we don't really know what's journalism anymore? And ombudsman, Mark mentioned the fact that now on the blogosphere you've got media critics and all this kind of stuff. Are they sort of fulfilling the role of ombudsman in some sense, or do you think you still need the, what we've got, what you have set up there, and what other official ombudsmen do, even at a time when there's so much more media criticism now than there ever could have been before?
Well, I can answer that one. I mean, of course, it sounds like job justification, but the difference is that 80% of what people are doing on the blogosphere is opining without real information. And so I have a hall pass within NPR. I have access to finding out the answers to why that story ran or what happened with that particular story. So, people can comment and say what they think, but, the number one, again, that I just keep going back to, asset of any media outlet is their credibility. And so hopefully I would have more credibility than somebody who's just, you know, saying what they think. Which doesn't mean that the bloggers can't draw attention to something, but I mean they draw attention to everything. So
I have to believe that. I have to believe this, even if I don't necessarily believe it. In 10 years, this is going to settle out. The dust is going to settle from what's going on. I believe that citizens want credible, clear information, and not just about the news, but about journalists, and about journalism. It will be more important than ever to have somewhat objective form of evaluating what's out there, whether it's coming from the blogosphere or from the New York Times. So I think that the form of media is not as relevant. It will continue to be important, probably more important, and I believe it will happen. It may be more likely that you start seeing a media website develop like Politico that is smart, professional, and broad in its purview. Media criticism is a great way to do this. Somebody who's able to comment on what's going on in the blogosphere, at least the parts that elevate themselves to widespread circulation, will be critically important. But that role will be far more important than it has been in the past, I think.
Questions? Liza?
I am Liza Gross from the International Women's Media Foundation. I would like to ask you regarding the press councils. Can you give me a sense of what the gender breakdown is in these press councils and whether they have made any pronouncements or have investigated or have looked into the coverage of women's issues such as honor killings, violence against women in high conflict areas?
I know that they have done. I mentioned, I believe, in the report, one instance in which I believe it was an ombudsman in Istanbul, was talking about whether a newspaper should ban a journalist who was wearing a headscarf from working in the newsroom. I didn't do that kind of sort of analysis of their complaints. I know that that issues of reporting of violence against women are among them, but I can't answer more specifically.
Question in the back.
One quick comment. I can't resist jumping in, Alicia, on your torture issue. My name is Morton Squar. I'm the former director of Human Rights USA. Almost every controversial issue of that type can be viewed as a political question rather than an objective analysis. And I think there is an objective standard that tells you what torture is and isn't. And that's in the various international standards that are set out. And it specifies that severe pain and suffering, including placing somebody in a situation where they can be in fear of dying, constitutes torture. So I don't think there's any dispute, any question about whether waterboarding is torture or not. So I tend to agree with the people who are suggesting to you that you have to be more specific about that. There is an objective standard, and it's not being applied by the Bush administration or by the media. In a more general observation or question, I just wanted to ask everybody, especially Mark, the concept of self-policing in a place like China, for example, ends up being a situation of government control. How do you deal with the idea that you want to push self-policing and the code of conduct approach, but it's misused in authoritarian situations?
I'm the one who said that, and I'd say, yeah, you're right. So shall we drop the conversation?
Yes.
Well, we should drop the conversation of self-policing because in China it would not work?
Yes.
Okay, we have a fundamental disagreement.
Yeah, I think anywhere journalists can talk about self-policing.
Yeah, they aren't going to raise things in China that give the government excuses, but basic good journalism practice, there are elements, I think, in any country, you do have to encourage journalists and the media to do that. I wouldn't say let's go and establish a press council in China, because, yeah, that's playing into the government's hands there. But small steps, I think, should be taken everywhere where journalists are able to.
Are you talking about a difference between self-policing versus self-regulating? I mean, I wouldn't say that the American news media is self-policing, but they certainly self-regulate because there are no laws, save for getting a TV license, you know, that regulate the press here. But the press has certain standards that they have created. For instance, to not mention the name of a rape victim. That comes just from the press. That's their own regulation. Not quote children under 16 without asking their parents. Is a self-regulation.
Right here in front, please.
Yes, my name is Rita Gerona Adkins, or Herona Adkins. I write for Asian Pacific American audiences here in the United States, and also occasionally for a publication. This probably is a very small area of concern relating to the bigger issues that are being raised here, and which, of course, are not necessarily being resolved. But if I may take advantage of sort of kind of expressing a sense of confusion and discomfort on my part as a journalist and as a reader, as a consumer of news, it refers to the word terrorist. Ms. Shepherd had raised the question about torture. When do you recognize it as torture or not? And the question that my sense of discomfort is that where is the difference between what is terroristic and an effort on the part of a group to assert independence or against discrimination in the society where they're part of, and if these are liberating, if we can use that word, liberating kinds of motivations for such groups, when do their tactics in asserting themselves become terroristic?
Let me address that briefly, because I know that Alicia's job is thankless, as I would say. Our job is not to answer that question. Our job, I think, in what we're talking about here, is to be sure that every community, whether it's as large as a country or as small as a publication circulation area, actually is able to have a conversation about those things. So that when the media uses words or doesn't use words, the people who are the consumers of the media, who I am maintaining, are the people who and I think these guys agree, are the people we work for. So those people have an opportunity to question what the media is doing. I believe, and I will say that my wife gave me a hat that has glass half full on it because I insist on being an optimist. I believe that people will, if they have those conversations, arrive at conclusions that fit the standards of their community. I don't believe those standards have to apply necessarily in all cases to the entire world, but they certainly need to apply to the community. Some of them should apply to the whole world, but not all of them. So I think that that's what we're talking about here, is being sure that the media is listening, is responding, is thinking about its own product and the way it's delivering its product. And by doing those things, is becoming stronger as a supporter of appropriate community standards, of open societies, etc. Is that?
Bill, that's a great way to end. We're out of time. Thank you for coming.
If anyone is interested in my card, and you can sign up to receive anything that I write, it will come to you by email. I don't know what that, and then you can write to me.
I'll trade.
I think I've got you.
I'd like one too.
Yeah.
Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.